Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and we heard in our last segment how the American sedan is dead. Well, the American magazine industry may not be dead, but it is certainly in crisis. The latest wrinkle, Glamour just announced it's shutting down its print edition. But there was an era of glossy page glamour writ large here in New York that preceded it. For example, New York in the 80s saw both decadence and disparity as the decade zeitgeist formed, and one magazine both captured and added to it under the direction of its first female editor-in-chief. And joining us now is Tina Brown, whose most recent book is just out, The Vanity Fair Diaries, Power, Wealth, Celebrity, and Dreams, My Years at the Magazine That Defined a Decade, now out in paperback, gives us an inside look into the politics and glamour and intrigue of New York's 1980s media scene. We won't talk much about one of the constant figures in that 1980s media scene who had certain orange mane. We'll talk about what's left of the magazine industry today and why Tina Brown ends her new book predicting a new golden age of journalism. Hi, Tina. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you so much. It's wonderful to be here.
You've done so much in journalism leadership, Vanity Fair in the 80s, The New Yorker in the 90s, Daily Beast in the 2000s. Why this book at this time?
Well, I was actually looking back through my diaries and thinking about doing a memoir when I realized that this period, this discrete period of this 8.5 years when I edited Vanity Fair from 1984 through to 1992, it was just a roller coaster era that was so interesting, frankly, to read about in the day by day. I didn't want to be cutting it and making it into themes and chapters. It seemed to me that the diary itself was so vibrant with the flavor of that period that it actually was worth publishing as a piece, as of itself.
A lot of people listening right now weren't even born in the 80s or weren't old enough to read Vanity Fair. How did Vanity Fair in the 80s define the decade, as the title of the book puts it?
Well, Vanity Fair burst into bloom, as I say, sort of the year before in 1983. It had two editors that had failed, and I was brought in then to try to sort of bring it back from the dead of its bad launch and decide what it was going to be. And I mean, Vanity Fair was always about aspiration, about glamour, about telling stories that people wanted, the people you wanted to know about who were booming, and the people as they fell. It was always, that was always the kind of defining sort of motivation, if you like, of the pages, which was to be watching the people aspire and watching them fail when they did, as well as succeed. And it was an extraordinary era of high energy social life under the Reagans. And that's kind of really died completely. But the black tie era of the big gala, the charity benefits, the Women's Wear Daily, the newspaper owned by John Fairchild, which really chronicled all of these society walkers, as they were called, escorting the First Lady and the Bel Air crowd and the Park Avenue crowd. It was so much of a kind of a world that has actually disappeared now completely. And it was fascinating for me to kind of delve back in, re-find those characters, remember the stories we told about them, and kind of bring them alive for a new generation.
Why do you think that world has disappeared? Have American values changed?
Well, social life entirely changed, you know. I mean, I don't have those dresses anymore. I'm glad to say, those poof dresses and the red nails and the whole thing. It was an era.
I think a lot of people are glad they don't have those clothes they wore in the 80s.
They are
anymore.
So happy, and you know, it was the dynasty era, and it was the rise of Lady Di. All of these things. I mean, it was the start of celebrity culture. That's what it was, and we chronicled that rise of celebrity culture from the very birth of it, in a sense, to its kind of boom.
Certainly the dailies in New York, the tabloids, were including Donald Trump as part of that celebrity culture in the 80s. Was Vanity Fair?
Very much. I mean, actually, I extracted The Art of the Deal, Donald's, his first kind of big hit book in 1987. And I remember I write in the diary about taking home the manuscript to our house at the beach, and reading it with sort of a fascination, thinking to myself, this, and I wrote in the diary, you know, this is BS, but it's authentic BS. Trump has a voice that I think people are going to resonate with. And I felt that straight away when I read the book, actually. And I did take the extract. And I was very glad I did, of course, because it became a big hit.
Listeners, questions for Tina Brown. Do you want to remember the 80s? Do you want to remember Vanity Fair? Anything else that you want to say or ask of Tina Brown? 212-433-WNYC. Do you have a favorite issue in plastic wrap somewhere in your attic or whatever? 212-433-9692 on magazines Then and Now. You recall your very first cover as editor, and Blonde Ambition, right?
That's right. Yes, the first cover was very important because I arrived to find, as I mentioned, the magazine was kind of dying. And one of the reasons it was dying was it was putting on the cover these black and white photographs of very prestigious writers. And I frankly have always thought that writers should be read and not seen, right? And actually what people wanted from that cover was glamour and vibrance. So I put on the cover, first one, a wonderful portrait by Helmut Newton of the then unknown Daryl Hannah with her eyes blindfolded and an Oscar in each hand, like the scales of justice. And it was a little inside joke too, which is like the magazine's life in the balance. And it said, Blonde Ambition. And Dominic Dunn, who was the writer that I had just discovered, who was before a film producer who hadn't really written any magazine articles, I met him at a dinner party and I immediately thought he had a great voice and I assigned him to do this piece. And it was a wonderful package, actually, in which he wrote about the aspirations of blonde actresses in Hollywood and everything they went through and, you know, the history of the starlet from the time of Lana Turner. And it was a wonderful piece and it was a great bang to begin with.
One famous photo from 1985 is referred to as the Reagan Kiss of Life photo. Can you describe that for people who have never seen it?
Yes, the first cover that really took off, the first magazine of ours that came, you know, that really took off, was about a year into my editorship when we were still kind of trying to get our footing with readers and advertisers. We had got access to the Reagans through various reasons, and to get to do a photo shoot, and I asked to come with me Harry Benson, who is, of course, the great photographer who's taken many, many presidents' photographs over the years. I took him because I knew he'd be fleet of foot and he would get in there and get out fast. The Reagans, we were told, were going to stop by in this sort of room outside the state dinner room where they were on their way to a big state dinner for the president of Argentina. And we waited and we heard the rustle of their clothes and we heard, you know, the Secret Service arriving, Nancy in a black beaded long gown, Reagan in a dinner jacket, so elegant, movie star couple, you know. And they walk in, and as soon as they walk in, Harry Benson had cleverly brought with him a boombox, which seriously dates me, and began to play this tape of Frank Sinatra singing Nancy with a Laughing Face. And as he did that, Nancy turns to Ronnie and says, "Oh, Ronnie, that's our song. Let's dance." And the two of them start to foxtrot together to the music without a care in the world. Of course, Harry Benson starts snapping like a lunatic, jumping up and down with his toilet brush hair. And I'm just thinking, oh my God, we have a fantastic cover shoot here. And we put the dancing picture on the cover. And then inside, at the end of the shoot, they turn to each other and give each other a pure movie star kiss. It's absolutely like some old-fashioned poster. And I know immediately, the Reagan kiss, we have this incredible image. And it really goes all over the world, those images. They really do. It was viral before there was viral.
So you wrote about, or published about, all these celebrity things and high society things. And yet the 80s in America and certainly in New York, as you know and as you write about, was also an era of very serious things. The income inequality that we talk about to this day was really coming into fore with all these Wall Street high rollers and people who liked the glamour of Reagan and et cetera. Yet street homelessness in New York was really becoming a thing. In the 80s, you write about, I think you used the phrase that Vanity Fair dined out on decadence. How did you manage that discrepancy in your own mind and as an editor?
Well, I mean, we covered both ends of it. And I think one of the darker themes to the diaries, frankly, is the AIDS epidemic. Because what really struck me when I was going through my diaries to publish them was I was at funerals so much. I was at a funeral like every couple of months of somebody that I loved and knew. The people I work with in fashion and the arts and design, they constantly had were contracting AIDS and dying. And it was tragic and very much a sort of a theme in the book about this darkness that was living inside all of this glitter that we also covered. And, you know, we tackled those dark topics in Vanity Fair. And, in fact, one of the things that I'm proudest of, really, was that very early into the AIDS epidemic, we decided to do a double-page spread, two double-page spreads, actually, of all of the people who had died in the arts and culture of AIDS as a statement about how much our world had been diminished by the AIDS epidemic. And we had to get the permission of every single one of those people's relatives or partners to ask if we could use the photograph because AIDS was so much a taboo. You know, it always said in the obituaries, you know, he died, you know, of pneumonia or he died after a long illness. It would never say AIDS. And we had to get that permission to do. And each one of those calls was a wrenching call to make. And some of them really debated whether they wanted to do it, which in a way is such a kind of picture of that moment that AIDS could be such a taboo. Nobody actually wanted to say their loved one had died of it.
Tina Brown is my guest on WNYC. Her book, The Vanity Fair Diaries, Power, Wealth, Celebrity, and Dreams, My Years at the Magazine That Defined a Decade, is our guest here on The Brian Lehrer Show. We'll continue to talk about that. We'll continue to talk about magazines today. And we'll start to take your phone calls at 212-433-WNYC. Anne in Chelsea and Timothy in Washington Heights. You'll be one and two when we come back from this break. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with legendary magazine editor Tina Brown. Her book out in paperback, The Vanity Fair Diaries, Power, Wealth, Celebrity, and Dreams, My Years at the Magazine That Defined a Decade. And Anne in Chelsea are on WNYC with Tina Brown. Hi, Anne.
Hi, can you hear me?
Just fine.
Great. You both are fantastic. Thank you so much for everything you do. Tina, I just want to say the first Vanity Fair I ever saw was the one with Michelle Pfeiffer on the cover. Uh-huh. She was talking about Tequila Sunrise. I was too young to get a subscription, but when I came of age, that was the first magazine I started to subscribe. I have the first 10 years of every Hollywood issue, which I adored. And the Demi Moore cover was great, but my favorite will always be Deborah Winger when she was going out and doing publicity for The Sheltering Sky. The photographs were great, and that was one of the best interviews ever. She was real. She was raw. She was fabulous. And all of the writers, great stories, journalism, everything. It was absolutely perfect, and you made my young years so happy. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Oh, my gosh. Well, that's so fantastic that you remember that in so much detail. You know, as you were saying that, these covers were flashing before my eyes. That Michelle Pfeiffer cover was actually one of my very, very favorite, too. It was by Herb Ritts, and she was wearing that gold dress, and there was sunset on her. And that gold dress was a Calvin Klein mini dress that became one of the best-selling items of his collection that year. It just flew out of the stores thanks to Michelle Pfeiffer's glorious bod wearing it.
And thank you. Timothy in Washington Heights here on WNYC. Hi, Timothy.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my call. Tina Brown, I think it could be argued that your time at Vanity Fair in the 80s, you know, enabled that, the me generation culture of the 80s. You helped cultivate that. Do you bear any responsibility, or could you be responsible, or Vanity Fair responsible, for that evolving into this current culture of deplorable narcissism that's plaguing our country?
So you're blaming me for the birth of celebrity culture. Well, I think what an editor does is reflect and predict, you know, the zeitgeist of their times. That was what was happening. We had a celebrity in the White House, a movie star in the White House.
But you also have to make value judgments about how you want to participate in the culture at any given time, right?
Absolutely. And what Vanity Fair did and always had done was that great mix of high, low, deep, and glamorous. You know, we would, on the one hand, we would do the glitz and the rise of that glitz. But on the other hand, we would do an amazing 10,000-word essay by William Styron about depression, his attempts to combat it, that ended up being a most influential piece really on that topic that had done that far, and ended up being a book that he turned into something which for which he used our headline, Darkness Visible. So we always did mix and in some ways, you know, the seduction points of a magazine are what makes you buy it, you know, those the movie stars, the glamour, the beauty, whatever, and you'll buy it for that. But then you'll end up reading the William Styron piece. That was always the kind of the two-step that Vanity Fair did. So I feel we did a good job of reflecting, predicting, and also, you know, the cover, the culture and its highs and its lows.
One related question about your time at The New Yorker, which was controversial. Critics at the time thought you were dumbing down an intellectual magazine, but I believe you also hired people like Malcolm Gladwell, David Remnick, who of course went on to be editor, Jeffrey Toobin, and Jane Mayer, all doing great work to this day. How do you look back on the essential challenge at that magazine?
Well, the charge that I dumbed it down, of course, is hilarious, because in fact I raised the intellectual standards tremendously at The New Yorker. The magazine had become somewhat dormant and somewhat less intellectually exciting. And I brought on the writers that you mentioned, and many, many more. And they're all still there, and they're doing their great work. Jeffrey Toobin, who was a young assistant attorney I hired, and he, of course, became our legal correspondent and now is a very, very well-regarded legal correspondent. Remnick, who you mentioned. Adam Gopnik, who was an art critic and who I sent to Paris, and he completely, you know, changed what he was writing about. I feel really very proud of how we turned The New Yorker back to being the golden magazine it had been years before.
Do you think that people mistook shortening the length of some articles, which I think you did, with intellectual heft?
Well, I think the people who thought that were quite honestly ignorant of The New Yorker's history, because one of the things that I did when I took it over was to go back to the magazine of the 30s, which was Harold Ross's magazine, the founder of The New Yorker, and the pieces were much shorter in those days. What I always believed is that length should earn its position. So actually I did do, for instance, a 25,000-word piece about murders in El Salvador by the junta there. But at the same time, I would do much shorter pieces in the front about, you know, the O.J. Simpson trial, if that was what was happening that was of great legal interest to Jeffrey Toobin. So, you know, it was all about that mix. And I think the people who didn't understand that were often people who pretended to read The New Yorker and never really had.
Noelle in Allendale, you're on WNYC with Tina Brown. Hi, Noelle.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Great, thank you.
Tina, I admire you so much. I love your work. I always have. I read Vanity Fair. I have forever. And New Yorker. And you did turn The New Yorker into a more vibrant magazine, in my opinion.
Thank you.
I love magazines. And I think they're coming back. I think people are still reading them. I think it's a vibrant culture for the portraits of people and writing, and I don't think they're dead yet.
Well, I very much hope not. I mean, I you know, it's certainly possible that the kind of trough one has seen, as screens seem to have won, may well have a different pivot. I am less obsessed now with the physical product of magazines, more obsessed with making sure there are ways to get and ingest, if there is such a word about words, the magazine content that is so good. And I personally love the tactile nature of magazines, but I also have to be honest with myself and say, do I rush to newsstands to get magazines? I don't, like I used to do, but I do go on my iPad and read everything, and I'm constantly reading in other formats. And as long as it's there, I don't really care, as long as that content is there.
Right. But I think part of the issue in the industry is not only screens versus physical tactile magazines, as you say, but also that when these same magazines get most of their readers online, and I think probably more readers than a lot of legacy publications have ever had before because of the, you know, ease of distribution online, for some reason, there's not the advertising model to sustain it. How big a problem?
It's a huge problem. It's brutal. And I'm very bitter about it on behalf of all the journalists and photographers and editors who have been put out of work by this horrible catastrophic explosion of the business model by digital, feasts upon content free.
Why? How do you understand the business decision there if there are all these new eyeballs seeing all this content?
Well, unfortunately, because the eyeballs get measured in exactly the amount of time they spend on that particular thing, it means that advertisers will just think they want to be around pretty content for a start. I mean, you know, you'll never find that advertisers want to be around a big 25,000-word piece about the murders that I mentioned in El Masochi. They just don't want to be there. And what a magazine offers is a package where you can say, okay, I'm advertising the magazine. I want to be at the front of the book. I want to be next to the wine column or whatever. I mean, you could make that work.
People are going to flip through
the
pages.
Yeah, I mean, the problem now, of course, is that people know that it's the eyeballs are there for just a minute or whatever. It's not worth the spend to put it there. And it's tragic because that has really the only answer is subscription. And unfortunately, because editors and publishers in the early period when the web came out were way too supine about letting their stuff be stolen, you know, and were sort of conned by the Silicon Valley concept of, oh, this is great exposure for you, great sort of, your brand will get great exposure, and they happily kind of gave content away. Then when you try to make people pay for it, very, very difficult to kind of retrofit that appetite for paying. And I must say, when I hit paywalls, I tend to move on, you know, and that's the thing we have to get through now.
Yeah, there was also a cultural idea around at the time, not just a business model of giving away people things for free as a loss leader and then they'll come to you, but I think also this cultural idea that information wants to be free on the internet, and there was a lot of resentment about any kind of paywall.
There was. It was a huge cultural con that was perpetrated on the world.
Con?
Why? Because I think that brains and diligence and care has created great work. It shouldn't just be given away free. You know, I mean, someone has to underwrite that labor. And what is really tragic now is that so many publications cannot afford to pay for that labor to make the quality good. And that means laying off and firing and, you know, and folding. And so the quality suffers and so does democracy. So, I mean, I feel quite strongly about that, as you can tell.
And yet, in our last 30 seconds, you end the book by stating perhaps a new golden age of journalism is approaching. How do you see it?
Optimism. I'm really hoping. I mean, one great trend actually is the fact that the digital geniuses who've redesigned our world are beginning to turn now to the problem of what has been created by digital disruption. And so you have tremendously big minds like Jeff Bezos, like Mark Benioff, like the new owner of the LA Times, who's a biotech billionaire, buying media. And I think it's good. I think it's great if they're getting into buying media because they have the funds to support it.
Tina Brown's book is The Vanity Fair Diaries, Power, Wealth, Celebrity, and Dreams, My Years at the Magazine That Defined a Decade. And if you want to see Tina in person, she'll be in conversation with the writer Jay McInerney Tuesday, December 4th at the Kaufman Concert Hall on the upper... Kaufman Concert Hall? Is that the... that's not...
At the Y.
This is the 92nd Street Y. Yeah. That's what it is, the 92nd Street Y. Tina Brown next Tuesday. Thank you so much for joining us.
And don't forget
us.
To listen to my podcast, which is now TBD, which has now been posted. So I'm pleased to have that too.